Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck and I'm your host for this first hour. I'm going to focus this first hour a lot on the resource sector and a lot on some individual stocks. We're going to spend some more time on the stocks because I think now is a great time to take a look at everyone's portfolio and just make sure that you're positioned in stocks that look like they have catalysts and that you truly understand what they're going after. Because in all fairness, even though a lot of the juniors have been drifting over the last month or two, they're still well up from where they were 6 months ago. And maybe taking some profits, not a bad idea, but also understanding that news will continue to drive these stocks. I'm kicking off the show with Jote Mazumdar, editor of Exploration Insights. Jote, let's start off with your general comments on the precious metals sector. As I mentioned, gold, silver, they're a little bit off their highs, but overall, you look at something like gold and it's still had a very good year. How are you viewing the overall health of the precious metals sector?
Thanks again for having me, Corey. Yeah, the precious metal sector is doing really well, I would say, from the producer down to the explorer. I mean, the producers have obviously done well with much higher margin assets. You know, a lot of these majors are booking reserves at about 1,200, 1,250, and with a gold price, you know, over 1,900 or around 1,900, you know, that's almost at 2,000 at some point. The margins are there for them to generate significant free cash flow, as I pointed out to subscribers several weeks ago in the letter. But also their balance sheets are better. You know, the only issue is some that have been overexposed to Latin America have been impacted by suspension of mining activities due to COVID-19. But the rise in precious metals, gold and silver, has allowed them to generate more margin from the assets that are producing. That's somewhat mitigated any of those production losses. So the producers are doing well. The developers have been able, like the good developers I'd seen over the last 6 months, have been able to raise equity prior to actually getting their debt sorted out, which is, you know, a bit strange. Usually you get, you know, interest from the banks and then they put out, terms based on the fact that these guys, the company will end up with enough equity. But now the good ones already have that equity in hand. And, you know, one example for me would be Bluestone Resources with their Cerro Blanco project in Ecuador. I mean, they're financially supported by the Lundin Group, but in addition, they've been able to raise a significant amount of equity such that, you know, they could start, you know, basically, construction if they wanted to towards the end of the year, just on their equity and their next catalyst is to sort out the debt. So that's on the developing side. And then on the exploration side, we've seen, you know, $6 to $7 billion of recapitalization, you know, in Canadian terms, year to date in the mining, junior mining sector. And we've seen that most of that directed at precious metals. So what comes out from this, you know, from the precious metals summit, you know, where I had about 40 meetings, is that, you know, having money right now is not a distinguishing feature with these juniors. Everyone seems to have money. Now it's about, what are you going to do with the money? And a lot of them are drilling, which is a positive, and so we should expect a lot of catalysts. But, you know, the opposite side of, you know, raising all that money is, you know, the valuations are getting a bit toppy, such that, you know, are we going to see a bit of a drop when the four-month hold of some of these private placements comes off towards the end of the year? That's a bit of a risk, but if you like the company, it might be an opportunity for you to pick up shares.
So how worried are you about that, Joe? In all fairness, I think we already have started to see some stocks drift lower because of, well, the shares that will become free trading, and also because of the fact that a lot of these financings are trading well above the financing price. So it is natural for these stocks to fade.
Yes, and yeah, that is a risk. I mean, I'm not worried about a lot of my companies just because, I think that they're worthy assets. And, you know, if they come down, then it might be an opportunity to pick up more. But if you pick up a levered story whose, asset is a bit more shaky, you might be worried. You might be more worried such that, you know, it, when it comes down, it might come down really hard and have very little support. What you'd want to see is that when it does come down, there's a lot of support. What we've seen in the financings that have been interesting, over the last several months is, you know, companies have cut back the demand. You know, it's not as if they had to, downsize their financings. The amount of oversubscribed upsized placements was significant on, a high proportion. They like to announce these upsize, oversubscribed. That might be a strategic thing by some of them, but a lot of them have left enough demand such that even after the placement's closed, it trades above or at a premium to the placement right away because there's just a lot more demand. And so when you're looking at your company that you bought, look at how they actually structured the financing, were their warrants issued, And so if you do have warrants or if it was flow through, there's probably a higher risk that people will be selling at the end of the 4-month hold. If people raised, not a significant discount, they've got a lot of money and they're drilling and that news flow is still coming, there might be less of a risk that people might sell. Because the other problem, the issue is because of all that money that we've raised, a significant amount of that's going in the ground, thankfully. But everybody's doing it at the same time such that we've got, an overflow at the assay labs because also the assay labs are, are productivity challenged because of COVID. They can't have that many people in the lab. And that social distancing has made their productivity a lot less. So something that's rushed right now in terms of an assay that might have taken a week or two before is now taking about as long as a normal assay, which might have been 2 to 4 weeks. Now, people are talking 6 to 8 weeks with just, a non-rush job. So we're going to see a lot of this news flow that's being generated through this field season in North America still coming out, January, February next year.
Yeah, very true. I can't even count how many companies that I've talked to that have just said, look, assay labs are backed up and we're waiting on our drill results, but we don't really have much clarity as to when we're going to get those. It's really out of the company's hands. But Joe, as you even mentioned, a lot of money has been raised. A lot of drilling is happening. What has you excited about this drill season and potentially any results that you're watching for?
Well, I managed to pick up a few companies, during the mid-March drop, and one of them that I've liked and, have had as top pick was Liberty Gold, which is drilling this oxide, open pit target in the Great Basin, Idaho. And that one looks very interesting to me in terms of, generating a potential resource that, a mid-tier or a major might want. Given its jurisdiction, the metallurgy so far has been good, and the amount of gold and how it's dispersed within the favorable horizons there at Black Pine. So that's one I'm really excited about. They got 4 rigs on, but given, the issue with the labs, there's no real point in adding more rigs because, you're just going to delay everything even more. And so the problem with some of these, drill programs right now is that when you actually not only want the results to show your investors what you're doing, you also want the results, importantly, to find out where you're going to put more holes and drill more and focus. And that's getting a little bit more problematic now, such because it takes such a long time to get the drill assay results back. And so people have to more strategically plan their drill programs now because the results take a little bit longer to come in.
So is that shying you away from some of these more seasonal drill plays like the one, say, in the Golden Triangle or even further north in Canada or Alaska, the fact that they're not getting their drill results back, so they are still, in a way, drilling blind? They can't use the prior results because they don't have them?
Yeah, it all depends on the type of deposit. The problem at Black Pine is it's Carlin style oxide. I mean, that's just what it is. But, you know, the whole idea with that gold is it's very, very fine, and you can't tell. You can tell the favorable lithology, the favorable alteration, but you can't tell if that's really high grade or moderate grade or low grade, because the gold's, you know, not visible to the eye, naked eye. Whereas in other areas, let's say high gold, which is up in Alaska, the gold, the precious metals there is associated with a lot of base metals. And so that's visual. So that's easy to know, okay, I've got to fast track this intersection because that's going to have a lot of grade. And so the more the gold is associated, or the mineralization that you're looking for has, you know, an association with, you know, massive sulfides or something like that, that's visual, whatever it is, and you've been able to define it, you know, you focus on this regardless. You would have an idea that this is what's going to run. It gets more problematic when you're looking maybe at an epithermal deposit and you go, well, you know, this is the texture I want, but I've been wrong before. You know, I'm not sure if this is going to be great. But if you've got the right texture, you're going to probably put another hole in that area, you know, but you may not know what the grade is. You know, I think when you're motivated by geology alteration and all that, you'll know where to put the holes, but you might not know if that's got the best grade right now because of the delay with the assays. You know, I don't have an issue in terms of saying, oh, I'm not going to buy this or I'm not going to buy that. I just have to understand the risks of you know, the news flow is going to be a lot slower.
Yeah, well, fair enough. And you know what? Eventually, we will see a lot of drill results and news coming out to the market. But right now, it seems like we're just getting a lot of exploration updates with companies telling us, look, they have drill core in the lab. They're just waiting for it. Joe, what about the balance between gold exploration, or gold juniors, let's call them, and silver stocks? Silver stocks really made a run as silver was moving higher, but when you compare how far off silver is from its all-time highs about a decade ago, and the fact that gold actually reached all-time highs just a month or two ago, the silver stocks, I think you can argue, really outperformed broadly the gold stocks.
Oh, absolutely, because, I mean, silver plunged even more during, you know, the March plunge in a lot of commodities. You know, we saw, you know, the gold to silver ratio go over 120. Now it's come back and moderated, I think, but, you know, 70 to 75 or something like that. And so that's a big jump in relative valuation. And that's, you know, driven by silver outperforming gold over that period. And then the issue right now is, how do you get that silver exposure? And that's why companies like Silvercrest do so well, is because you're trying to look for a company with an asset that's got a lot of silver exposure, you know, like Mag Silver or something like that. It's harder to find that geologically. That, you know, because a lot of people use silver equivalents, but then you find out that, oh, silver is only 30% of that overall revenue. So if silver price goes up, they're not as exposed to that as, let's say, zinc or lead or copper or something else, you know. And a lot of the silver companies have converted to gold companies over the last 5 years because of, you know, it's harder to find these silver deposits, and silver hasn't done so well. And so there's very few out there that are very exposed to silver. I mean, one that I own, but it's a big company like Pan American Silver. I mean, despite the COVID issues with shutting down and suspending some operations, they've outperformed most of, you know, the 25 companies I looked as a cohort of precious metal producers, you know, since the middle March, you know, drop. You know, they provided a lot of leverage to the precious metals. And so, yeah, the issue is not that silver is doing well, is like, how do you expose yourself to it? And I've been having issues trying to find, you know, exposure like that in the juniors.
Joe, also, what about the balance between companies listed on the TSX or TSX Venture Exchange compared to Australian companies on the ASX? Because, again, these Australian companies have also outperformed broadly the Canadian companies.
Well, and they've outperformed because they've actually been finding things. You know, it's very discovery oriented exploration, and they've done really well. And that's been over the last 18 months, even before we've had them, you know, gold go up. We've seen a lot of, you know, high quality discoveries in Australia, Western Australia, Victoria, New South Wales, and, you know, a lot of places. And so I have begun to, you know, I've always owned ASX, and I've lived in Australia and worked there and did one of my masters there. So I'm quite comfortable with Australia, and I'm looking to expose my, you know, get more exposure in the portfolio to Australia. And I've picked up some Australian names that I know, where I know the people, like, you know, Stephen Nano, who was the ex-CEO of Mirasol. He's starting up a company called GBM Resources, which is looking at low sulfidation epithermal deposits in a known district in the Drummond Basin in Queensland. And so that is something I've invested in, because, you know, I like the people, I like the idea, low risk jurisdiction, no COVID issues with respect to generating news flow. They've raised money. And so I am doing some of that. And, you know, another one, a bigger market cap one that I got was, you know, Bellevue, which has got a really good deposit in Western Australia. And also, one of my better plays was actually a nickel thing in Vietnam, which is listed in Australia, called Blackstone, which is BSX. So yes, I'm definitely have my eye consistently now on ASX listed companies, because the valuation is not so high prior to the discovery. And so there's not a lot embedded in there, and such that when they do make the discovery, that's when the pop is, not prior.
You're not too concerned about the share structure of these ASX listed companies? I know a lot of people were talking about that years ago, saying they just blow out their share structure, but it doesn't really seem to matter right now. Everyone's ignoring
it. No, you know, when we talk about share structure, my problem is not that some of these guys have 300 or 400 million shares out, but there's not people with 75 million shares that are priced at 0.05 cents. You know, and that's the problem with in Canada, is that you got all these structures where people, founder shares, or people have escrowed shares at, you know, at a very low cost. And those things come out in the market and they're continuously dumped into the market. And so whatever happens with the news flow, there's always people selling. And so, you know, I'm less concerned sometimes about the number of shares outstanding as about how much the cost of each share in there, you know, and it's more difficult for people to do that sort of thing on the ASX listed companies than what happens in Canada.
Joe, before we switch focus to another sector in terms of resource sectors, any other stocks that I assume you're, I guess, patiently waiting for in terms of news flow?
Oh, I mean, Corey, almost all of them. It's, you know, they've all got money and they're all sort of, you know, moving towards generating news flow. Some of them are hampered by the lab issue that we were talking about, but I mean, they're drilling, and so I'm patient on there. The ones that, you know, I've got more of an issue with, I guess, are the ones that are more exposed to Latin America or all in on Latin America, which I've sold a few of those, because, you know, COVID-19 it's just a bit risky in terms of not only getting permitting because the bureaucracy is delayed because of COVID-19 and everybody staying at home, but also drilling, getting people and stuff like that, or even exploring because of COVID-19, because, you know, you go to a remote place and they don't want you there and you shouldn't be there. Because they don't have any medical facilities or anything like that. The few companies I do own there are now permitted and now, you know, going to drill, you know, like Regulus in Peru. You know, but some other ones have had issues, like in terms of, you know, things that they would have liked to have been doing now, but can't.
All right. Well, Joe, one other sector that I do want to get your question or comments on is the battery metals sector, especially lithium too, because we had news that broke at the very beginning of the week about Tesla signing a contract with Piedmont Lithium for 5 years, potentially 10 years of supply from their North American operations in North Carolina. Do you see more interest coming into the battery metals because of this story or for any other reasons?
Yes, I mean, it'll certainly drive investor interest back into the lithium market when, you know, a big player like Tesla starts, you know, using their capital to invest in these little juniors. I mean, I've owned and sold Piedmont Lithium, but not at the price levels it is now. I was disappointed that they issued a lot of equity in earlier in the summer, you know, at a massive discount, and when I was waiting for a deal like this. So that was the issue for me. When I owned Piedmont, the idea was for them to generate a high margin product like lithium hydroxide, which is the product that's, you know, basically the one that's going to be used mostly in the new batteries and the NMC 811s over lithium carbonate. That's the high margin is generating lithium hydroxide. High margin is not generating a spodumene concentrate, which is what this will be. So, you know, a part of their plant or their proposed plant in the Carolina Belt is going to be supplying Tesla, who are building the lithium hydroxide plant for their own batteries, because that really is the chemistry. That really is the difficult part of the equation. But that's also where the high margin comes in. Mining a high strip open pit that grades head grade of 1 to 1.5% lithium oxide, and then upgrading it to a spodumene concentrate that's only 6% and shipping it to Tesla is not, for me, in my opinion, a very high margin business plan. Granted, it's only a third of what they're thinking about doing, I believe, right now. But it gives them, some of that mining output guaranteed, and gives them a name in the sector. So it's a big boon to them, considering that Albemarle and some other companies are in that district and never have made a deal with Tesla. So for Piedmont, that's definitely a big shout out to their management team to pull this off.
What about any other metals that do also get tied into this whole battery metal narrative?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think of it less as battery than greenhouse gas emission reductions. And so you could think of even palladium in there because of the catalytic converters. And before you get the penetration of the EVs or the electric vehicles, you know, you still have that imposition of reducing your emissions. And palladium is trying to fill that gap, and it may fill the gap longer if the EV penetration isn't that big. So I still like palladium. I like nickel, because that's becoming a higher loading in the ultimate battery that's gone from nickel manganese cobalt 111 to 8111, and might even be more nickel concentration. So that class one nickel, which is the nickel sulfide deposits, is what I'm focusing on, that. And that's that project that in Vietnam with Blackstone. And also copper, because if you're doing all this electrification, that's the best conductor out there. And so copper is another one I'm constantly looking for, hence, you know, the investments in Regulus and also things like Trilogy Metals.
All right, Joe, we're going to wrap it up there. We are out of time for this segment, but great having you back on the show, buddy. Thanks for taking some time on this weekend's show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend, and I'll reach out to you, and I'll touch base in probably about a month's time. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you very much.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing on with the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report, and continuing to focus broadly on the resource sector, I am now chatting with Adrian Day, president of Adrian Day Asset Management. Adrian, let's start off with the precious metals, still going through a bit of a correction. But in all fairness, you look at something like gold trading still right around $1,900 an ounce. That's a very nice price and also a very nice year-to-date gain as well, even though it is a little more than $100 off of its highs. Let's start off with gold and this correction. Do you think that this correction has pretty much run its course, or is there some more downside that you think people should be aware of?
Well, hello, Corey, and thank you for having me on your show. I think there's still potential for downside. I mean, I always sort of said that, you know, throughout August, gold was trading just above its 50-day moving average and just above or just on support. It kept bouncing up, down to support and bouncing off. So I always said to people, if we broke through that support, we had the risk of going down to below 1800s. And my target was 1810 to 1820. So just a target. So on that basis, we will still have a little bit more to go. I mean, what we've had so far, if you look at the last, you know, few weeks, depending on what day you start at, I mean, we've gone from basically 1950 to 1885. I mean, let's face it, that's pretty minor, pretty modest for a, quote, correction. And in every gold bull market I can think of, you had multiple pullbacks of that size or more. So it's not a concern to me. I think what happened was, you know, from March until the end of July or middle of July, you had a pretty orderly move upwards, and then you had that kind of spike. And any time you see any market or individual stock, for that matter, I won't say exponential, but move dramatically higher above its trend, you're probably going to need at least consolidation, if not a correction, before it starts moving up, we hope, again. And I think that's all it was with gold. You had huge inflows into the ETFs, huge inflows into funds and so on in June, July, and then August it started to peter out. You just ran out of buyers in the short term. And just an example, in August, I think it was just a little bit over $1 billion into global gold ETFs. Compared with over $3 billion as the average for the year. So dramatic fall off, still positive and still a nice number, but a dramatic decline of inflows for the year. And I think based on the yearly inflows. And I think that just means that momentum was, you know, you were beginning to lose some momentum. And you were running out in the short term of buyers, which meant you either needed some new impetus to get gold moving again on the upside, or gold was vulnerable to a correction based on some known or unknown event. And of course, what provoked it was the dollar rallying. The dollar had been weak for most of the last 6 months. It rallied. Now, it rallied, interestingly, because of concern about, you know, the resumption of or the second wave or whatever of COVID in Europe and also in the United States. And one might say, well, the concerns, the cause that, and so people went to a safe haven, a risk off, people, I mean, risk on, people go into a safe haven. One might say, why didn't they pick gold? The reason they picked the dollar rather than gold was because the dollar had fallen and was arguably short-term oversold with huge speculative shorts, whereas gold was arguably overbought short-term, trading, you know, above its 1 year trend line or 6 month trend line. So I think that's why people went to the dollar rather than gold, if that makes sense. So we might get a little bit more. I mean, I'm not a daily trader, but I think we could easily see gold slip a little bit more especially since October is often a sort of weak month, September, end of September, October. But I think fundamentally, you know, it's still an incredibly positive environment for gold.
And that's the long-term takeaway, right, is that it is still an uptrending market that right now seems like it's going through a very natural correction. When it comes to some of the longer-term catalysts that you're watching, does it just simply come down to central banks, currencies, and unfortunately a little bit of politics?
There's no question. There's a lot of factors that are bullish for gold, but overwhelmingly, the single most important factor, in my view, is the policy, in quotes, of central banks around the world. And I say in quotes, I really don't think they have a policy. And if they do, it's not a very good one. So the QE infinity is in the US and similar packages in Europe and Britain, isn't it? The Bank of England is now talking about negative rates, whereas 6 months ago, a year ago, the bank was adamant against the efficacy of negative rates. And Japan, of course. Ironically or interestingly, China, of the major economies, has actually been among the more restrained in its central bank policy. But so long as the central banks remain exceptionally loose, which means low interest rates and therefore negative real rates, and the central bank balance sheets continue to increase, what we have in the U.S. is at the moment is essentially an MMT, modern monetary theory, which is unfunded spending by Congress and the administration, both of them are to blame equally, spending money which they don't have. And the Federal Reserve is simply creating the dollars to accommodate that spending. That is an exceptionally bullish environment for gold, in my view. And I should say, I don't see anything likely to change that. They might become less loose or more loose. But the idea at the moment of the Federal Reserve tightening is laughable, frankly. You know, Jerome Powell is no Volcker. Volcker's not on the horizon. Trump doesn't want a Volcker. I think the only good thing, no, I shouldn't say that. But Jimmy Carter, to his credit, let's just say that, appointed Volcker. The right man at the right time. But the Fed, Jerome Powell recently said in answer to a question when he was asked when he thought the Fed might raise rates again, he said, "We are not even thinking about raising rates." And with regard to the balance sheet, get this, he said, and I'm quoting, "I believe we may never reduce the size of the Federal Reserve balance sheet. We will simply let it decline in proportion to a growing economy." Now, I mean, if that's not bullish for gold, and then this idiot policy, perverse, I should say, is a better word, because I'll use idiot later, a perverse policy of a federal bank actually trying to generate inflation, the 2% target, and then saying, well, we're not just going to hit 2% and say we've hit our target. It's going to be a 2% average that we want to achieve. So therefore, we're prepared to go over 2%. I mean, when you think about it, just think about it. The central bank is charged with maintaining the stability of the currency, right? The purchasing power of the currency. That is their main mandate from 1913. And the Federal Reserve is now saying, in fancy words, because the Fed always speaks, you know, so that people don't quite understand what they're saying. The Fed is now saying, hey, we want consumer prices to go up. Think about it. They want prices to go up. It's the most perverse policy for a central bank that I've ever come across. So long as they have those policies, it's a perfect environment for gold.
Fair enough, Adrian. And you know what? I think, as you said, Jerome Powell has flat out said that they're not going to get any tighter anytime soon. Well, the balance sheet probably will stay right around the same level, unless of any new policies. But I think the factor is, what are some of the new policies that are going to be there to juice the market? And if they can even get some increase in inflation. What about, though, the reaction in the precious metals stocks after the breakout in gold and silver? Gold to new all-time highs, silver still lagging quite significantly below all-time highs. We saw stocks move higher, but really over the last couple months, if you're looking at big names, those are grinding sideways. They're trading in a range. It's a much higher range than where they were. Now, coming into earnings season, expectations are these majors are going to produce some pretty good earnings. Are you seeing any value within the majors, precious metals majors, that is?
Yeah, absolutely. And first of all, what you say is true, and it's important. I mean, a lot of the stocks had good runs at the beginning of this bull market, you know, after March, but they've been pretty much sideways for a while. I'm just looking at, you know, Barrick. You mentioned Newmont, which is the largest. I'll mention Barrick, which is the second largest. You know, it was beginning of April, it was $18, and, you know, it ran up to, I mean, it did get to over $30, but basically since July, it's been within 3, 4, 5% of where it is now. Am I seeing value? Yes, I absolutely am. And this is what's so astonishing to me. Normally, when gold price goes up, right, at the beginning of a bull market, the first things to move are the big major mining companies. That's normal, right? The big ones move first, and then selected exploration, you know, they have a discovery, hit a good hole, do a good promotion or whatever, they go up. But for the broad part, the exploration stocks move later, and the seniors move first. When you consider, A, the seniors move first, B, we are at all-time highs for gold pretty much, right? We're equaling 2011 prices. And when prices go up, you normally have multiple expansion, right? Same in any market. And when you consider that the senior companies, for the most part, are superior companies today than they were back in 2011-12. And by superior, I mean, you know, we had that huge change in management, right? Remember in 12, 13, 14. And the new managements came in preaching discipline. They weren't going to overpay for acquisitions. They were going to focus on profits. They weren't going to focus on growth. Remember all that? So our gold high price and better companies, and it is given that, it is ludicrous to think that the senior gold companies, for the most part, not all of them, are selling about, you know, 50% or more of their highs. You look at Barrick, for example, it's at $28. Back in 2011, it was at $55. Same for Newmont. Same for several of them, Yamana, etc. So it just doesn't make sense. But you know me, Corey, I believe in value. You know, Oscar Wilde talked about people who understood the price of everything but the value of nothing. So I'd mention price, but let's talk value. If you look at the senior and second tier producers, right, they are trading right now on any valuation criteria that you want to look at, they are trading in the lowest quartile. If you take price to cash flow, which is one of my preferred metrics, price to cash flow, other than the last quarter of 2018, right, that group of senior and second tier producers has never traded at lower price to cash flow multiples. It just doesn't make sense. So if gold is going to continue to move up or resume its move up, I think the seniors are still the place to go. And Rick Rule likes to say, don't buy hamburger when the filet's on sale. So I think the seniors are definitely still a good buy. And, you know, as you know, I like the juniors, but I have to just say that.
All right, well, let's drive down into the juniors. It's a broad-based recovery that the juniors saw. A lot of juniors, a vast majority of them, are cashed up, and a lot of drill programs are underway. Are you seeing any value, any opportunities within the juniors?
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of these are still at very, very good prices. But in this correction, generally speaking, broadly speaking, they haven't come off as much as one might have thought they might, given how sensitive, you know, smaller companies can be. I think one of the best sectors where I'm seeing real value right now are in the smaller or newer royalty companies. And some of these have come off really quite significantly to good valuations. The senior royalties, of course, which I still like, don't get me wrong, but no one's going to confuse Franco-Nevada with a Graham and Dodd value investment. But you look at some of these juniors, they're quite good value now. Look at Metalla, for example, which has come off 20% from its August high. Had a good run before that, of course, but I think it's a good buy now. They've just done three very attractive royalties, you know, one high potential, one almost certain, one near production, etc. So that's one. Look at Nomad, which is the new company started by some of the people who used to do royalties at Osisko Gold Royalties. And, you know, it's not a small company. It's 700 million market cap. They've got big, strong backing from the Quebec institutions. But that's come off from, I don't know, $1.80, I think it was, down to $1.50. Or look at Elemental, which is a much smaller one. It's a new one. The company's been around 4 or 5 years, but it went public, started trading last day of July. It's been a royalty company for a few years, but you know, they did an IPO at $1.30. It opened actually over $2, but it was trading around $1.70-$1.75 for most of the time from end of July until the last couple of weeks. It's now at $1.34. You know, it's trading at less than book value right now, which is a pretty low valuation for a royalty company, especially a royalty company with, you know, more than one asset, which they have about 5 producing at the moment. So I may have missed one, but and I'm going to get a call from one of the companies, I'm sure. But I think it applies to a lot of the smaller or newer royalties. Well, Eurasian, EMX, is not new, of course, but that's down from 330 to 260 in the last month. Origin, however you say it, which is the merger of Evrim and Renaissance, and there's an exploration company, but they are looking for converting their exploration interests into royalties. It's a royalty, a goal that they have. You know, that's come off almost 50% since the excitement over the merger. So, I mean, I think these things are very good. That's where I'm finding value right now.
All right, Adrian, we're going to wrap it up there, but always great having you on the show. Thanks for those insights into, well, large precious metals companies all the way down into some small ones, and most importantly, if or where you see value in the precious metals stocks. Adrian, thanks again for your time on this weekend show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
And you, thank you so much.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Cortland Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. We are continuing to focus on the precious metals sector, resource sector broadly, and some of the junior companies, as I am wrapping up this first hour with John Kaiser, founder and editor of Kaiser Research. Now, John, before we get into some individual companies, there are a couple key points that we need to outline for investors that are in these junior stocks. First and foremost, it was 3-4 months ago that this financing window just exploded for the juniors. A lot of money has been raised. It's great that companies are now cashed up, but even on some of my prior interviews in this first hour, that's not a distinguishing factor anymore for juniors because so many of them have money. Take us through, though, John, some of your research in terms of how much money was invested and how many shares are coming free trading in the near term.
Between May and August, TSX Venture Resource listings did a total of $769 million worth of financings, with the peak closing in August. Since then, the interest has died down considerably. And in Canada, these private placements have a four-month hold. So the May financings are now coming free trading in October. And of course, the May financings were the ones when this market was just taking off, when the awakening was underway. Those will have the lowest prices, and those ones will be in the money. And because most of these financings included warrants, and we have this overarching concern that the general equity markets are going to tank during the last quarter of this year, which of course would drag down all the resource juniors and probably in the interim, the price of gold, as people sell the most liquid asset of all in order to raise money to either pay off the debts that they piled up, the leverage, or to even go bottom fishing by the dip in the big New York NASDAQ markets, because the Fed has said we will not tolerate a meltdown in the equity markets very long. We will print money and we will buy assets in order to keep this from becoming a free fall like it ended up in 1929, heading into 1930, where they had this V-shaped recovery, and then it faded again 6-7 months later, which is about sort of January 21st, when inauguration date is coming around, and then it went down relentlessly for the next several years. There's this put out there that the Federal Reserve will not allow this to happen, but if it does crack, it will have another plunge. And so the resource juniors, the audience has said, okay, gold's backed off into the 1700, 1900 range. They're not putting fresh money in. There's a whole raft of shareholders, hundreds of millions of shares issued. A lot of it even now still in the money. That's going to be looking to exit itself, because either way you look at it, we're heading into a bottom fishing season for the resource sector. That December-January period is always a major slowdown in exploration activity. Most of the results are in by early December for the work done this year. So we're heading into a news flow slump, into a wall of paper coming free trading all the way into January. And they won't have spent all the money. So it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy that people want to sneak out of stocks and have a huge pot of cash ready to do some serious bargain hunting in December while we wait to find out who actually won the U.S. election.
Yeah, well, the whole election throws another wrench into this. But one thing about the shoulder season, we can call it, especially in the Northern Hemisphere, where certain areas have to shut down and other areas are waiting for the ground to freeze to actually get some drills on site. This can be a slow time for the market, you're right. But assay labs have been so backed up. I hear they're running 6 to 8 weeks on even rush assays. So that does mean we are going to be seeing a flood of news coming out from, say, the Northern Hemisphere again. But, John, is this news going to be enough to drive or hold stocks at these generally higher prices if the company can't immediately follow up on some of these results?
It depends on the nature of the results. If you've got an exploration play that's one of these rethink plays where you already have an existing mineralized zone and you're just producing more similar information, incrementally growing the system better. And if you do happen to have a winter shutdown, such as is the case in the, most of the Golden Triangle, there is really no, nothing to convince new money to buy. They'll say, this is great. I'm going to wait for the stock to go down. And in the Golden Triangle, work resumes in June. So, for example, two companies that I follow are Skeena Resources and SK Mining. Skeena owns the northern 5-6 kilometers of that whole Salmon River formation, which runs for about 25-30 kilometers to the south, and SK Mining owns the southern 25 kilometers. The SK Mining guys had a late start because of all the COVID-19 protocols. They had bad weather in terms of cloud cover where they couldn't get their geophysical survey done. In fact, they're only getting their geophysical data now, but they did mount a 3,000-4,000 meter drill program to test some targets along the strike after re-logging all the core. But they've already said, we have to get out of there by October 15th. So they got two rigs there. They're doing this sort of scout drilling along targets like Jeff and TV, where there is the VMS potential. But it's unlikely, since they're not even able to use the geophysics to guide the drilling, that they'll produce like a brand new discovery where people will say, wow, I'm going to keep buying this right as the news comes out all through the season, because we know this is going to go bigger and bigger. Now, Skeena to the north already has its PEA out, a significant resource that has become much more valuable with gold lurching into the $1,700 range. And they are now busy doing the exploration they couldn't do while Barrick still had the back and right, which was looking for other feeder zones, exploiting the Sin volcanic faults through the rhyolite, and that somewhere fed the contact mudstone. But there's all these other lower and even lower mudstone units, which when the fluids go past them, these act like sponges. It bleeds laterally into them, creates these localized deposits. So Skeena will be able, by virtue of having those millions of ounces there and gold probably making its launch through 2000 sometime in the next 6 months, they'll be able to hold their own. And I do not know if they will be able to work through winter, but they have the, the value of the existing resource plus the ability to stretch the drilling as long as possible, because they have a major camp in place. But for most of these Golden Triangle plays, they need to deliver something really exceptionally new based on a concept to get anything more than a blip out of the market. And then it's going to be great for bottom fishers to look at these, study the results. And a lot of the assays won't trickle in, as you point out, until December because of these COVID protocols. And of course, now we have COVID infections surging again as we head into the flu season. So they're going to make these protocols even more strict, which will slow down things even more. And perhaps the benefit of that is that you can keep holding your breath a lot longer, that the final hole suddenly delivers a great surprise in December, by long after one would have expected all the results to be in.
Oh, John, that's going to be a tough hold, though, isn't it? With all these shares coming free trading and potentially just a further drift in share price, I could see a broad-based sell-off happening due to a number of these factors. One other thing that you brought up there is COVID protocols at the assay labs. What about the potential of this second wave of COVID impacting actual drill programs? I've talked to a lot of companies, and they're all doing a lot of hard work to make sure all their workers are isolated on site. And it does sound like they're doing everything they can. But if we start to get a couple more, I guess, nervous shutdowns, what are we looking at then? Is a possibility of drilling just not even being able to happen?
This is a big problem for Quebec and Ontario, where there's also lots of First Nation communities, which are particularly vulnerable because they are isolated. And they've been key drivers behind making sure that their communities do not get infection in them. Of course, their communities are staging areas for the exploration groups. And that's a big concern because in Ontario and Quebec, January is when you roll up your sleeves and go drilling when all the horrible swamp and bog and the lakes are frozen so that you can go in there, move your drill around and not worry about sinking in the mud. And this is supposed to be kind of like what gets us going heading into the new year. It's part of the Great Canadian January effect that usually climaxes with PDAC. But of course, PDAC is not a physical event this year. It's a virtual event, which means it's basically meaningless, like all these other virtual conferences that the market is saturated with right now. So this is a big concern of mine, and a number of my companies are counting on a January drill startup with potentially very interesting results. It's a big concern.
Yeah, it really is, unfortunately. But hey, you brought up Quebec and Ontario. I think that should be a focus for investors, as I've heard a number of people saying that they really like the Val-d'Or area. There's been a lot of good work done right on or along that border, too. Great Bear Resources, I interviewed them again this week. They continue to have very nice drill results. There's also a lot of money raised in these companies in this area. What do you think, John? What attracts you in the Quebec and Ontario region?
Well, there's two companies that I'm watching particularly closely in the Red Lake District. And Great Bear Resources, of course, is the $800 million valued company, which has that 22-kilometer LP fault structure, which really was a conceptual discovery. Because what pulled them into that area was the original Dixie property with its 100 holes and a very lame resource that they got from Newmont for next to nothing. They did some clever thinking and found the Dixie Limb Hinge zone with very high-grade, flashy Red Lake-style gold. But that ended up not having significant tonnage potential. But they took that old lithoprobe data from 2004 when the government was looking for a place to stash its radioactive waste. And they could see the linkage of the deep crustal faults feeding the Red Lake District. And there was one feeding this LP fault, and they had staked this. And when they started drilling it, lo and behold, they started getting different style of mineralization, not the sort of mafic-hosted Red Lake style that gets really flashy, but more disseminated sulfide-type mineralization where if gold is visible, it's a speck that you have to look really hard with a hand lens to find. And now they're talking about a potential tonnage footprint as big as Hemlo, which was, you know, 22 million ounces with the underground portion running 8.5 grams. So they have their 5-6 rigs or whatever it is right now turning in that area. You can work through winter. You know, Red Lake is a great staging area for that. And the one that I'm watching right now is Golden Goliath, which is also purely conceptual. Their Packwash fault, it's to the south of the LP fault. It's never been drilled, so nobody knows really what it's made of and whether it has any gold in it. There wasn't any huge gold in soil geochem anomaly in that area. But Golden Goliath went in there, has done all the basic data sets, and now they're in a drill program, and they're encountering all the busyness, the alteration, the sericite, the, you know, quartzite, porphyry systems, everything that, and even the disseminated sulfides backing up the IP survey saying, okay, everything's here. All we need are the assays. And this thing's valued at 30, 40 million. And they also have a nickel financing coming due in the next few weeks, which was done in May when they were still in the garbage can and nobody believed that this thing had any potential. So this type of play, if you know, by mid to late October, they start delivering first at least some gold showing that the Packwash fault is pregnant just as the LP fault is, and then some of the better target holes that they're drilling now, which they did later than initially because of weather conditions and soggy ground conditions, if they start delivering ore grade type intersections, then we have a brand new discovery based on pure concept and grassroots exploration work. And that's the kind of play which if it catches fire, you know, it would go up 20 plus times just to be on a par with Great Bear, which of course it's not going to do overnight. And Great Bear itself, it's at $15 right now. If they're only down about 400, 500 meters or something like that. The Hemlo system went down, I believe it was like 1,400 meters or so before they stopped mining it. So at the Great Bear, if they can keep building this thing through systematic drilling, you get this thing ramping through $20 and beyond, becoming that, okay, bona fide. Here's the Hemlo of the 2020s decade, and here's the little junior with conceptually similar new discovery. And then everybody else, well, where else does it go? What's to the west of Pakwash? Who else has stuff in the Red Lake? Then you have kind of like a regional play getting a lot of legs, even in this time of COVID. And so long as they can keep all those COVID protocols intact and prevent, you know, local communities from getting infections, we could have a lot of fun in places like that.
All right, John. Well, maybe a place to focus on. I know I hold shares in a number of companies in that area, and a broad area play could be a possibility. But again, this is going to just depend on drill results. These stocks move on the back of good news. The metals price is supporting higher prices, but it's the stocks that you really need to focus on and make sure they're doing the good work and getting out, hopefully, some good news. John, we have to wrap it up there. We're out of time for this first hour. I hope that you have a great rest of your weekend. I appreciate you joining us. Everybody else, please keep those emails coming. Fleck@kereport.com. I've gotten a little behind on those emails, so I'm going to play a little catch up this weekend. John, everyone else, have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks, Corey. You too.